Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for sharing part of your day with us. Whether you're listening on the radio, online, or on demand, I am grateful you are here. New Yorker staff writer Susan Orlean fancied herself to be a bit of a chicken whisperer, especially when she was living on her Hudson Valley farm where she kept the birds, some of whom were named Merry-Go-Round, Tweed, and Mabel Black Label. She also kept guinea fowl, turkeys, cats, dogs, and even some cattle. The love of animals has been a lifetime affair for Susan. As a child, she convinced her mother to let her keep, in her words, a, quote, gift mouse she received from a boy at school. And if you were wondering, she named that mouse Sparky, and then Sparky had babies, and that was that. And then there was her beloved Irish setter Molly she had in college. Yes, she had a dog in college. And while, of course, Susan has written bestsellers about orchids and libraries, she often returns to animals. Over the years, her writing has taken us into the niche worlds of pigeon racing, a New Jersey tiger lady, and the taxidermy community. Now, some of Susan's essays are collected in her new book called On Animals. Joining me now to discuss the book is Susan Orlean, who will be in conversation at an in-person event for the book at the 92nd Street Y on October 25th. Susan, welcome.
I'm so happy to be with you.
Your first story you ever wrote as a child was about animals. What was it?
I wrote a book when, according to family legend, I was 5 years old. I'm not going to put that up for examination, but that was what it is supposed to be, my age when I wrote it. It was called Herbert the Nearsighted Pigeon. All the characters in the book were animals, and the protagonist was a nearsighted pigeon who was having strained relationships with his friends because he was having trouble recognizing them because he needed glasses. So the story has a happy ending. He got his glasses. But it was very interesting to me that even at that age, when you might have imagined I would have written a book about a little girl, because I was a little girl, that's the subject I knew the best, I gravitated towards writing about animals.
Now, many kids love animals, but they kind of grow out of that love of animals. What made you become more and more interested?
Some of that is beyond my ability to really know. I think it's an instinct that you have or you don't have, that you get joy and delight out of seeing animals and gravitate toward them. A lot of us have a very moderate kind of appetite for animals. We maybe are happy to have a dog, but we're not that interested in animals beyond that. For me, it was something that I just was always drawn out of curiosity, affection. And then as I became a journalist, to me, they were the entry point for so many fascinating stories. Mm-hmm. That I kept returning to the subject again and again.
You know, a lot of adults don't like animals or even pets because they're so unpredictable. I mean, they're animals, they're beings, they're living things. You can't really control them. Why are you okay with the unpredictability?
Well, it's not always my favorite quality. Oh, I'm just thinking about my pets. I have two dogs and a cat, and you know, sometimes they're in one kind of mood, sometimes they're in another kind of mood, and it can be very frustrating. On the other hand, that is the essence of life, and to be interested in other living things has a complexity and a nuance that is challenging and invigorating. People who collect or who are, you know, interested in and collect, say, China figurines, there's something very static about it. And I can see where if it interests you and appeals to you, it fills your life with a certain kind of purpose and pleasure. So I have no doubt that it provides a lot of satisfaction. But there's something utterly static about it. You acquire it and it is just there. it doesn't evolve, it doesn't change, it doesn't age, it doesn't surprise you. It has no capacity to astonish you. Living things, and part of our obsession with them and our attraction to them, is that exact quality, that it's a dynamic relationship that's changing all the time, that you're constantly recalibrating your emotional range when it comes to another living being. And that, I think, is where it becomes so interesting and sustaining in a way that an inanimate object is not.
My guest is Susan Orlean. The name of the new book is On Animals. I would love for you to read a little bit from the book. And I'm going to say it's from the chapter called Show Dog. People, don't at us when you hear certain
right.
words. Do not at us.
Right.
That's all
right.
I'm going to say.
Please,
go ahead, Susan.
Please. And just remember the context, because it's completely legitimate. So this was a wonderfully fun story for me to do, where I was profiling, well, I won't tell you anymore, but I'll just begin. If I were a bitch, I'd be in love with Biff Truesdale. Biff is perfect. He's friendly, good-looking, rich, famous, and in excellent physical condition. He almost never drools. He's not afraid of commitment. He wants children. Actually, he already has children and wants a lot more. He works hard and is a consummate professional, but he also knows how to have fun. What Biff likes most is food and sex. This makes him sound boorish, but he is not. He's just elemental. Food he likes even better than sex. His favorite things to eat are cookies, mints, and hotel soap, but he will eat just about anything. Richard Krieger, a friend of Biff's who occasionally drives him to appointments, said not long ago, when we're driving on I-95, we'll usually pull over at McDonald's. Even if Biff is napping, he always wakes up when we're getting close. I get him a few plain hamburgers with buns, no ketchup, no mustard, and no pickles. He loves hamburgers. I don't get him his own French fries, but if I get myself fries, I always flip a few for him into the back. If you're ever around Biff while you're eating something he wants to taste, cold roast beef, a Wheatables cracker, chocolate, pasta, aspirin, whatever, he will stare at you across the pleated bridge of his nose and let his eyes sag and his lips tremble, and allow a little bead of drool to percolate at the edge of his mouth until you feel so crummy that you give him a taste. This routine puts the people who know him in a quandary, because Biff needs to keep his eye on his weight. Usually, he is as skinny as Kate Moss, but he can put on 3 pounds in an instant. The holidays can be tough. He takes time off at Christmas and spends it at home in Attleboro, Massachusetts, where there's a lot of food around and no pressure and no schedule, and it's easy to eat all day. Any extra weight goes to his neck. Luckily, Biff likes working out. He runs for 15 or 20 minutes twice a day, either outside or on his Jogmaster. When he's feeling heavy, he runs longer and skips snacks until he's back down to his ideal weight of 75 pounds. Biff is a boxer. He is a show dog. He performs under the name Champion High-Tech's Arbitrage. Looking good is not mere vanity, it's business. A show dog's career is short and judges are unforgiving. Each breed is judged by an exacting standard for appearance and temperament. And then there's the incalculable element of charisma in the ring. When a show dog is fat or lazy or sullen, he doesn't win. When he doesn't win, he doesn't enjoy the ancillary benefits of being a winner, such as appearing as the celebrity spokesmodel on packages of Pedigree Mealtime with lamb and rice, which Biff will be doing soon, or picking the best looking bitches and charging them $600 or so for his sexual favors, which Biff does 3 or 4 times a month. Another ancillary benefit of being a winner is that almost every single weekend of the year, as he travels to shows around the country, he gets to hear people applaud for him and yell his name and tell him what a good boy he is, which is something he seems to enjoy at least as much as eating a bar of soap.
That was Susan Orlean reading from her new book of essays on animals. Was that as much fun to write as it was to listen to?
It was so much fun. It was fun to report, to spend time with this dog and see his day-to-day life. I mean, that was my curiosity, is what is the life of a show dog like? Do they ever play with a ball? Do they scratch their ear with their hind legs so they look silly? Or do they always look gorgeous and groomed and perfect? And I followed him around for a couple of weeks, just observing his life as this supermodel. Then sitting down to write it, of course, was so much fun because he was delightful and the story just had a lot of natural humor in it, which I really enjoyed.
You get into these animal/human subcultures. That's and often, to your point earlier, the animal is an entree into some other discussion or something else that could be investigated. And I'm thinking about the story that people in this area might remember in New Jersey, this woman named Joan, who was infamously known as the Tiger Lady after this 400-plus-pound Bengal tiger escaped from her compound in New Jersey, in suburban New Jersey. It was about 1999. She ended up having a lot of tigers, which I learned is called a streak of tigers. I looked that up. But your story is not just about the animals and their welfare, but it also gets into the legal system and how it deals with issues of animals and property. When you were reporting that story, what was one of your takeaways about the law surrounding animals and property and as property?
Well, you're absolutely right that this story really was a constellation of issues. And there was the immediate issue of what was going on with this woman and her 27 tigers. And part of the problem was that the state of New Jersey had been very negligent in... They had issued her an educational permit. You know, there are only a few reasons that you would ever be permitted to have a tiger. And one of them is if you're using it for educational purposes. Well, she had never demonstrated any legitimate educational point of her having a tiger. And yet the state issued her a permit. And over the years, she got more and more tigers. The state doesn't have sufficient staffing to follow up on all of these applications for permits. So on one hand, I hold the state responsible. On the other, I also understand that the people who are in charge of overseeing these permits for animals are often doing it on a shoestring budget, and they simply don't have enough manpower to follow up on all of these these permits. So she ended up having permits for maybe 5 tigers, which she should never have had to begin with, and then ended up with 27 tigers because she was kind of just acquiring them. Well, that extends to another issue, which is how on earth do you get tigers? Sadly, there are states that have virtually no laws governing the acquisition of exotic animals. So, and now with the internet, it's very easy to buy an animal, any kind of animal, online from one of these states that either very loosely regulates or doesn't regulate at all these animals. Then there's the other problem, which is how does society grapple with the issue of animal hoarding? Do we charge it as a criminal offense? Do we treat it as a mental health problem? Do we treat it as an animal issue? I mean, there are many different ways to look at this very complex problem. And we as a society haven't quite figured out what to do. And maybe the answer is that it's all of those things. It's a legal issue. It's an animal issue. It's a mental health issue. It's an issue regarding how easy it is to acquire animals. So that's a regulatory issue, all wrapped up in one. It's not going to go away anytime soon. And we really haven't figured out how, as a culture, to grapple with it.
You know, people approach animals in so many different ways. And it was interesting in reading the reviews of your book, because I know you probably know this. There was one reviewer who seemed to be very into animals and had a little bit of an issue with the essays. And I was curious, you know, the reviewer mentioned she thought there should be heightened sensitivity to the animals' experiences. Those were her words in this review. So I'm curious, when you thought about writing these essays in the first place, what did you see your job as? Were you an observer? Were you a reporter? Were you being an analyst about animal issues?
At my core, I'm a narrative nonfiction writer. I feel what I do best is to bring people to notice the world around them and perhaps notice either things that they didn't notice previously or to pay attention to things they already knew of but had not really looked at with the same degree of scrutiny or inquisition. I am not here to tell someone what to do, and I don't think that that's there are plenty of writers who do that, and that's great. That's not who I am. I have very strong feelings about animals. I have strong feelings about the right way to treat them. But I think what I'm good at and what I really pride myself in is to draw people into thinking about these issues more deeply. Writing a story about the saga of releasing or the attempt to release Keiko, the orca whale who was in Free Willy, to the wild is, you know, I found an absolutely fascinating story, a real saga of what had happened to this one whale. And implicit in the story is this question, which is, are we really in a position to keep orcas in captivity at all? And isn't the base of the problem that it's not really easy to provide a good life for an orca in captivity? I don't think that it persuades anybody by getting on a soapbox and making a powerful argument advocating one or the other approach. I think it's much more powerful to say to someone, come listen to this story. It's a really fascinating story, and you're going to learn a lot about the subject, and you're going to come to your own conclusion, and I can probably guess what conclusion you're going to come to, but I don't need to tell you that conclusion. That's not my role as a journalist. I'm there to guide you through the journey of learning about these subjects, and an educated person is in a much better position to develop opinions. That's my take on it.
The name of the book is On Animals. It is by Susan Orlean. Susan will be at the 92nd Street Y in person on October 25th. Susan, thank you for making time for us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I love talking about this book, so it's just a delight.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them. because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.